Sometimes, as dog trainers, we focus much of our attention on the dog and meeting the needs of that dog in front of us. Though sometimes we can lose sight of the person on the other end of the leash and accommodating their needs as well. In this episode of Fresh Bites on the Bitey End of the Dog, I have an educational conversation with Abigail Whithauer about effectively working with people with disabilities and ensuring that success can happen at both ends of the leash. Abigail also gives excellent advice on addressing the issue of ableism in the dog training community. And I hope the conversation about the many issues with ableism and how it can impact our friends and colleagues continues well beyond this podcast. If you are enjoying the Bitey End of the Dog, you can support the podcast by going to aggressivedog.com, where there are a variety of educational opportunities to learn more about helping dogs with aggression issues, including the upcoming Aggression in Dogs Conference, happening from September 30th through October 2nd, 2022 in Providence, Rhode Island, with both in-person and online options. You can learn more about the Aggression in Dogs Master Course, which is the most comprehensive course available anywhere in the world for learning how to work with and help dogs with aggression issues. Hey everyone, I've got the amazing Abigail Whithauer here, who's from Rover Chase, founder of the Rover Chase Foundation. I'm really excited about this episode because it's a topic I've been wanting to talk about for a while. So let me tell you a little bit more about Abby. She's the founder and owner of Rover Chase and has been a professional dog trainer for nearly two decades. As one of the most certified dog trainers in the southeastern U.S., she's a certified canine behavior consultant, a certified professional dog trainer, and one of just 70 trainers worldwide selected by Victoria Stilwell to hold the prestigious title of Victoria Stilwell Professional Dog Trainer. I just talked to Victoria the other day. She's a wonderful, wonderful person. Let's see, Abigail previously has worked as a veterinary technician, professional groomer, and professional pet sitter. When Abigail is not at Rover Chase, she can be often found on her small hobby farm in Alabaster and working with the nonprofit, the Rover Chase Foundation. So welcome, Abby. It's great to have you here.
Thanks. It's great to be here. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, this is a much needed topic that we need to talk about in the dog training community, and especially anybody in this community that's listening in. I think one of the topics that is not talked about enough is people with disabilities and what can happen when we're not being aware of those issues in our community and when we're working with clients, especially, and in our conversations with each other when we're talking about training techniques, because let's face it, there's many mechanical skills and physical skills we need in dog training. And that's where ableism can sometimes sneak up on us or sometimes hit us right in the face in some cases. And so I think it's very important for the dog training community to start talking about this more. So I'd love to jump right in and kind of start off with that topic. You know, what do you see as our current challenges in the dog training community today?
Yeah, you know, I think that when we're looking at each other as colleagues and co-professionals and realizing that from my perspective, at least, I think much of the positive reinforcement dog training community was established by women with disabilities and different challenges. They were some of our kind of first leaders in this industry. And it doesn't get talked about very much. And then certainly when we're working with clients, I think it's so valuable to be aware that your physical ability may be different than your client's physical ability, particularly with aggressive dogs that do take more technical skill and physical ability in many cases.
Yeah. So, and you have a very diverse background, rich background in a lot of different things. But I just mentioned you have veterinary background, grooming, dog training, service dog training as well. So it really brings in, you have a very, I'm sure, all-encompassing sort of lens and view of these issues. So let's talk about all the different disabilities that can exist and how we have to be aware of those things. So sometimes when I first started learning about this topic, it's, you know, you think about physical disabilities, but there's many other disabilities that we may not be able to even see or we don't often talk about. So in that regard, let's focus on that first, like understanding the needs of the entire community first, and then we can maybe jump into some of the more specific aspects. So what are your thoughts on that as far as how we as a community, dog training community, can help further that understanding?
Yeah, you know, I think we always say in my service dog nonprofit that every time we do a match camp, we learn something new about disabilities and the needs of our recipients, because it is always changing. And I've been disabled myself for 15 years now. And so even as a disabled person, we become more and more aware that disability is vast and it's really diverse. And it can change even on diagnosis to diagnosis. So just because I have certain disabilities within my diagnosed disabilities, another person with the same medical presentation may present really differently, and it changes over time. And I think in a lot of cases where people that don't live in community with people with disabilities are not close to them, often don't realize how much masking goes on with a disabled person to hide disability or minimize disability. And at least I can only speak for myself. I have the kind of personality that it is unlikely that you would know about it, except for the fact that I have a service dog with me, because I keep it pretty well masked. And that takes practice for me to feel transparent enough to share the truth about what's going on and what I am and am not able to do physically. And then it takes practice from people that are working with me to realize that I am likely to mask even when I'm probably at my limit. And I think that's really common.
And so I think what I'm hearing you say is that sometimes it may be something we have to recognize more as trainers in terms of asking the right questions or getting that information that's going to help us help the clients as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think we can do that really kind of on the front end, maybe in our intake forms, is put a couple questions in there that help us get at least a perspective before we even go into the consult of what we're looking at as far as physical ability, emotional ability. We always say that the behavior is expensive, and it's not just expensive financially, it's expensive physically, it's expensive emotionally. And those are good questions, I think, to ask in our intake forms.
What are some ways of asking those questions? Because it can be coming from someone that often has very emotional cases to begin with. You know, of course, we work in aggression cases. There's tons of emotions involved. You're often very careful about the language you're using, or you should be anyways,
yes.
Right? And so what are some questions that we can ask that are going to ensure we are building a rapport right to begin with? So we're already establishing that we're being sort of open and to understanding what they're going through.
I think we can ask really good questions about family history, which is always important. Working aggression cases, right? Who lives in the home? What are their ages? How do they relate to each other? And that often will bring up really pretty easy things. Like if you've got two adult humans and two children and then a grandmother, it's a reasonable assumption that the grandmother may have different physical needs or abilities in that home, just like the six-year-old child will have different physical needs and abilities than the 40-year-old parent. So I think that can sometimes just be inferred with really basic questions that we already do if we just think about them that way. But I think having optional questions where the owner can say things like, currently, are you able to physically control your dog? There can be some good clues into that question that is still dog-centered, where you're not really invading the person's privacy or asking questions they don't want to answer, but gives us some good clues. If they say, no, you know, I can't walk my two-year-old German Shepherd, he pulls me over. That's a really good clue about that. Sometimes clients will disclose really early in the initial part of the consult where you're taking history, and they'll be like, well, I had shoulder surgery, or I need to have shoulder surgery, or things like that that can be really valuable too.
And so what do you suggest when they're giving you that information and maybe you need to dig a little deeper so we can help them? So we have like actual specifics on maybe adjustments we need to make in our training strategies or what we're asking the client to do. Are there any additional questions you might add on top of that? Or even if it's in person with the client, once you meet with them?
Yeah. You know, I think we can always frame things as a question that's non-invasive. We want to protect their privacy of their health if they don't want to share, but we can say things like, so is there anything that we need to be aware of your physical health that is going to impact how we develop this behavior modification plan? And I think also checking in with clients regularly once we present the plan to them, be like, hey, does this seem achievable for you and your family on the very first session before we actually go to compliance and that kind of thing? Does it feel achievable? And oftentimes they'll disclose something at that point where it's like, no, you know, physically we can't do this, or I care for my elderly parent, or my child has autism, or whatever it is that is complicating their life. I think if we give them space, they generally do disclose.
I've come across the same thing. It's most of the time they are open, especially once you establish that you're a safe place to mm-hmm. disclose that information. And I think that's really important for us as trainers and consultants, is to create that safe space so they feel comfortable, talking about those things with you. Let's get into some more of the specific cases. Maybe you have a specific case that resonates with you lately, and perhaps we can jump to an aggression case, since this is the bitey end of the dog. Sure. Maybe tell me about a case that you've worked lately where you've had to adjust based on what's going on in that case and in its aggression case.
We had a very challenging case several years ago where we had an owner that really was just not physically able to put the management in place to keep everyone safe in the home. And that did change our recommendations for this dog. And, we asked questions like, is there any disabilities or special needs that we need to be aware of in this case? Because we started to have some strong suspicions that perhaps what needed to be done, this was quite a large dog, had quite a long history of a bite history. And physically, it became apparent that perhaps this individual was just not able to physically manage baby gates and two layers of protection and individual walks and separating the two adult dogs in the house, which was very needed. There was a lot of inner dog aggression as well as human directed aggression. And it did change how we recommended they move forward. And then, we were like, was there anyone in your family that could help you? Is there someone that can come and stay with you for a little while? There are choices there. But I think it often will change, especially with larger, younger, more powerful dogs with aggression histories.
Let's talk about some of the specific recommendations we can give in those cases. And I'll kind of go off on a side story here, is that one of the things I learned during the pandemic, moving everything to virtual consults, a lot of us did that, moving things online, is that you realize that you don't actually need to be there in person all the time. You can teach a lot of things without physically showing the clients how to do it or showing the mechanical skills or getting working with the dog yourself. There's so much you can do now online. So it made me realize that not only does it have to make us become better teachers, because we have to be able to explain things in a way that a client's going to understand and carry out on their own, even if it's just through words. Sometimes we have video examples, but it made me realize just how much we're capable of when we're able to communicate in a certain way. And so what are some specific examples of things that you would suggest? Let's say we have a client with some physical disability and we've got to make adjustments. Yeah.
Sure. So we recently had a client that she just had quite a rambunctious, young, short hair, blocky headed dog. And he was a charming fellow, but she was having a very difficult time getting the dog out of her house into her car to get to the group class to work on impulse control. That's where we were trying to get her, is from the inside of her home to her car to the group class. And we were having a lot of trouble. It was just a very significant power difference between the two of them. She'd had hip surgery, she'd had shoulder surgery, and she was older. So we ended up making like a leash system where we had a leash that was tied out to her front porch, and we clipped it on the dog inside the house. So she didn't have to hold the leash, and he walked with her to the end of the tie out. Then there was another tie out from the tree that you could pull over and clip from there, which took her to the car. And then she got him in the car and clipped him into the car. And then once she got to the group class, my staff simply came out and got the dog in with her. And we ended up back tying him in the group class, which worked beautifully. She didn't have to be as physically engaged with him. She was able to participate in that group class from a chair, which was incredibly helpful for her. And we solved that problem where my staff wasn't readily available to kind of bridge that physical gap with our little leash tie out transfer system.
Oh, that's brilliant. I absolutely love that. I would have never thought about that, but it's such a brilliant solution, really. And well, that again shows your experience with this, is that you can think of these outside of the box creative solutions. So tell me more. Like, how about, let's talk about some of the other disabilities that people might experience and how we might help. Can you think of any other cases where you've had to sort of come up with a creative solution like that?
Yeah, we've definitely, we certainly learned in this last match camp with our service dogs that we realized that when we teach a dog, whether it's come to board and train or it's a service dog program or whatever the situation is, how we teach the dog to deliver a received item is not very accessible to people with different physical abilities, as far as whether they are utilizing a wheelchair or whether standing and sitting on a repetitive motion is challenging for them. And certainly one thing that has with my own help is I cannot bend down and be on my knees at all. That is just not a thing that my joints allow. And so being able to amend bending over and squatting down with rolling chairs or with the ability to practice muzzle desensitization and training from a seated position rather than a floor position or standing position, and just learning and practicing it yourself. What my staff and I work with a lot is that we'll have a problem with, you know, just a normal situation that we're doing, reactivity or whatever. And I'll say, okay, well, what would that look like if you had to be seated for the whole time? What would that look like if you couldn't bend down to deliver the treat? How would we amend that? And we practice it amongst ourselves and we kind of make it a little training game with us as professionals to figure out, you know, spend a week working with your dogs at your house from a different mobility position than what you're used to. What would it look like to go through your normal training routine with your dog completely from a rolling office chair? What would that look like?
Brilliant. I love that as well. And again, nothing, something that I haven't tried myself, but it makes complete sense in the way you put it. It's just it allows us to experience it from that kind of point of view. And it then it also helps with the creativity, right? You start to learn, okay, oh, this is what I could probably do here in this particular case. That's really awesome. So keep going, because I love these ideas.
You know, I think one of my favorite things about learning how to do dog training, particularly with aggression and complicated cases that take a lot of physical well-being. You know, when I started my career, I was very physically fit. I was fast. I was agile. And learning how to shape a consultation with a dangerous dog with a known history where I know I cannot physically get out of that dog's way. I just don't have that luxury in my life anymore. And learning how to set up my consultation room with X-pens and pick boards and things that keep me at a distance, and also really gaining confidence, which I think most of us has gained during COVID, which has been really helpful. But learning that you don't necessarily have to touch the dog to work with it. And I think most of us that do aggression really regularly already know that, because we can't touch the dog in many cases. But learning how to do it at a distance, and learning that the foundation exercises that seem to modify these aggressive behaviors really well don't have to be as precise as we as dog trainers really want them to be. You know, it's like if I ask my dog to do a touch, I want it to look a very certain way. I want my hand target to be perfect and very precise, but I'm not sure it really matters in really what we're doing with aggression cases. We can be more flexible.
I 100% agree, because really with most aggression cases, as you know, it's about changing the underlying motivation or emotion that's happening mm-hmm. when that dog's around that particular stimulus. And so it's really more about a different kind of approach in terms of, big air quotes here, training versus something we're working with behavior. So much of it is, there's a lot of hands off, so there's no need to actually touch the dog, as you mentioned. And just to back up to that point, it's something we in the dog training community used to think we had to do. Oh, we've got to touch the dog. We got to get our hands on the dog. We got to start working with the dog on leash so we can show the client. And those are important aspects, sure, in some cases. But I've learned, just as you had mentioned, that we don't need to do that as much anymore. And in fact, it's often so much better for the dog, because what'll happen is that if we're hands off for a long time, the dog's like, I could trust this person because they've never come towards me or violated my space until I'm ready for it. And it can really help with that trust factor as well. So
yeah, absolutely.
We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to come back and talk more with Abigail about helping people with disability. Hey friends, it's me again, and I hope you are enjoying this episode. You may have figured out that something I deeply care about is helping dogs with aggression issues live less stressful, less confined, more enriched, and overall happy lives with their guardians. Aggression is so often misunderstood, and we can change that through continued education, like we receive from so many of the wonderful guests on this podcast. In addition to the podcast, I have two other opportunities for anyone looking to learn more about helping dogs with aggression issues, which include the Aggression in Dogs Master Course and the Aggression in Dogs Conference. If you want to learn more about the most comprehensive course on aggression taught anywhere in the world, head on over to aggressivedog.com and click on the Dog Pros tab and then the Master Course. The course gives you access to 23 modules on everything from assessment to safety to medical issues to the behavior change plans we often use in a number of different cases, including lessons taught by Dr. Chris Pockel, Kim Brophy, and Jessica Dolce. You also receive access to a private Facebook group with over 1,000 of your fellow colleagues and dog pros all working with aggression cases. After you finish the course, you also gain access to private, live group mentor sessions with me, where we practice working through a variety of cases together. And if you need CEUs, we've got you covered. We are approved for just about every major training and behavior credential out there. This is truly the flagship course offered on aggression in dogs, and is perfect for pet pros that want to set themselves apart and take their knowledge and expertise to the next level, or even for pet owners who are seeking information to help their own dog. And don't forget to join me for the third annual Aggression in Dogs Conference, either in person or online, from Providence, Rhode Island on September 30th through October 2nd, 2022. This year's lineup includes many of the amazing guests you might have heard on the podcast, including Suzanne Clothier, Jen Triock, Simone Mueller, Dr. Amber Batson, Kim Brophy, Karishma War, Laura Monaco Torelli, Dr. Simone Gabois, and many more. Head on over to aggressivedog.com and click on the conference tab to learn more about the exciting agenda on everything from advanced concepts and leash reactivity to using positive reinforcement to work with predatory behavior. And if you like to show off your support of the podcast, this year we teamed up again with the folks over at Wolf Culture for some catchy limited run conference merchandise. Wolf Culture is known for their witty, nerdy, and no-nonsense apparel that was created in 2019 to spread more awareness towards the use of humane training methods. Their apparel is here to help you start conversations, advocate for your animals, and rep force-free training in a different way. So don't forget to get your conference gear. It leaves the site after 12/31/2022. If you want 10% off your order, use the code BITEY10 at checkout. That's BITEY10. All right, we're back with the amazing Abigail Whithauer, where we're talking about understanding the needs and challenges in the disabled community. So I think when I first started working as a trainer, I'm like, okay, so how do I work with cases where somebody may not be able to handle their dog? And my mindset was always kind of like, okay, we're going to capture behavior. We're going to shape behavior, and it's going to look super clean. And like Ken Ramirez was there right on your shoulder, right?
And then
you realize, wait, you're right. It doesn't, you know, when you're talking about behavior and aggression, it's not about cleanliness of the training. It's more about, again, changing how that dog feels about what's going on. So you don't really need to do a lot of those sort of very fine-tuned mechanical skills with the dog. It's all about changing how they feel. So let's jump into some of the other, you know, disabilities, again, to help some of the trainers understand what they might experience out there. Maybe some of the intellectual or mental disabilities that people can experience?
Yeah, so I think, you know, where we see this most, and I think where most people see it, is with families that have children that have different needs, whether it's intellectual disabilities or social and spatial disabilities and differences. And, you know, I'm just a huge fan of Jennifer with Family Paws, and we're just big into what she does. I think she's brilliant. So we've really worked with a lot of their stuff on how to adapt that with families that have different needs and children with different needs. I've got a case right now with a young German Shepherd that had some bad training hours on him, where the trainer was issuing shock when the child would pet him to make the dog not growl at the child for petting. It was a very bizarre case, which of course led to several bites. And the child does have some differently processing neurological tendencies. And so we worked a lot on stuffed dogs with that child, on how to interact so that the German Shepherd, who was quite weary at that point of anything with the child, we worked with stuffed dogs. We also worked with our own dogs that loved kids and were really, the service dogs just don't, they're super chill. They're really bred to not care about threat gestures. So we worked a lot with that. And then we talked just a lot with the child about consent and about how the dog might be feeling. And we worked on those things. And we do that with adults too, that have different capabilities and different ways of interacting with their dogs in the world. I think to me, one of the biggest challenges is that if you have an individual that has an intellectual challenge and then also has fine motor skill challenges, I find those to be the most challenging, particularly in aggressive cases or cases where the dog has quite a very strong threat gesture opinion. I think that those can be a real challenge because it's very hard to navigate that. We do a lot of external targeting for that, where we teach the dog to target something that is not attached to the person, you know, like a little sticky note or something. And then the person tosses the food treat towards the dog so that there's just less fine motor skill directly involved in the dog.
Yeah. And it reminds me of a case I had many years ago. I think it's important for trainers to seek out resources in which they can learn more about a particular aspect of a case if they need to. And so many, many years ago, I had a case and one of the children in the home was autistic, but I didn't know much about it at that time. I was completely clueless on how to approach it, what kind of accommodations I need to make or changes in my behavior change plan. So I reached out to Dr. Risa Van Fleet, who was super helpful because she was able to give me information about more researching on my own, but also some tips to help in that case. So I think for the trainers listening in, it's a very a good resource to establish connections with your colleagues in the industry. Risa Van Fleet, certainly one, Dr. Melanie Cerrone, really anybody with a background in human psychology or therapy.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, the professional service dog training community is a massive asset. One thing I will say about training and placing service dogs is you see an enormous amount of diversity of presentation. And most service dog trainers have a lot of experience of adapting already known skills, so the things that the dogs already knows how to do, and quickly adapting them to various situations on their match that maybe they weren't prepared for during match camp or something like that. And they're a great resource. And service dog trainers just tend to be extremely creative because they have to be. We're creating a lot of behavior on people with a lot of different abilities to cue that behavior. So that can be a great resource too.
Yeah, I am a big proponent of cross-training or cross-pollination of, and you're a perfect example of somebody that has already, you know, you already have both worlds. You understand the service dog, you're an expert in that and the aggression stuff. So you're actually a great resource. I don't want to put you out there, but, you know, for people to reach out to, that's going to have that unique understanding because you're absolutely right. You know, there's so much difference in service dog training in that, in some aspects than there is with aggression. There's, of course, a lot of similarities, but mm-hmm. there's also a lot of differences.
Yeah, there's a lot of differences. And I think the other thing I would really encourage everybody to realize is available is that the vast majority of individuals with disabilities have a large team of PT, OT, medical professionals. And if you get stuck or you're not sure how to do it, man, those PT and OT professionals are amazing. And most of them are quite willing to work with you. I've worked several cases where I have asked the client's permission if we could bring their physical therapist or their occupational therapist to have a Zoom meeting and just be like, hey, this is where I'm trying to go with this. And I'm stuck and I can't figure out physically how we can make this happen. Or for the occupational therapist, I can't figure out how just on fine motor skills or in intellectual ability, how can we communicate this in a better way? And they tend to be amazing resources, even though they don't necessarily understand dog aggression or behavior. They do understand human behavior and they are really good at it. And they can be huge resources.
Yeah, it's such a good point about how collaboration with other professionals is just going to help that client so much more. Yeah. So I just wanted to back up to something you had mentioned earlier was when the dog is displaying aggression towards somebody in the home and you have a reasonable degree of suspicion that it's maybe the way they're moving or the way they're communicating with the dog. And I'll throw a curveball at you. Let's say they're having issues with understanding why the dog is behaving that way towards, you know, that they're witnessing that behavior towards that family member. How do we go about that conversation in a way that's going to be empathetic, but also going to communicate what we need to communicate?
Yeah, you know, I'm a big believer in direct communication. I think we lose a lot of ground. I know as myself, as an individual with a disability, I will also say that's preference. I like I'm a disabled person. That doesn't bother me. Some people really like to have the label after their personhood. So they want to be an individual with a disability. For me, I'm fine with being a disabled person. So just as a side note, that's fine with me. So you'll hear me reference both ways. But I think I like my doctors to be frank with me about what's happening and what our realistic expectations are here. And so I think if we have, you know, where we see this present most frequently with our aggression cases is in threat gestures, right? Perceived threat gestures, particularly with movements that are less typical from what the dog is used to seeing, whether that's with a cane or a walker, or just simply more frantic movements. And so we just talk, we have a pretty big spiel that we give about body language and threat gestures. I love Zoom because you can do that whole reach into the microphone thing and it really simulates that threat gesture. But I think we want to talk to them honestly about it and be like, hey, your dog is sensing this as a threat. We understand it's not a threat, but that learning is based on the learner, not the teacher, and that your dog is sensing this in this way, and here's why it's happening. So let's back up several steps and simply see if we can't counter condition and desensitize the way that your individual body moves and teach your dog that this movement is not threatening, just with a simple, you know, treat and retreat or whatever we decide to do for that. But I do think being frank with owners is really vital, and to say, listen, and we understand that this is a reality of your life and that this dog is struggling with compatibility in that reality. I personally believe to be what they're paying us for. They're paying us for our professional opinion. And if the professional opinion is that this dog is really going to struggle in a home with children with sensory processing disorders because the dog doesn't do well with loud noises and screaming, that needs to be stated openly and honestly.
Yeah, it's definitely important to be giving them an accurate prognosis, because sometimes their expectations may not align with what we're seeing as the professional coming into the case. And those can be difficult conversations for sure, because especially the cases where they've gotten the dog because they're looking for some level of comfort for that person in the home. Those are challenging cases.
I think those are my least favorite cases for sure. Mm-hmm. Particularly because we do work with service dogs as well. And it's so challenging to try to explain to a layperson that just loves their dog why this dog is never going to be as resilient or bomb-proof as a service dog selected for that purpose or bred for that purpose. And having those discussions is really challenging. And I think there's a huge amount of under-education in the pet dog community, just that you can't just go and get a dog and make it your service dog. That cannot be. And, yeah. You know, I'm sure that you see this all the time. Often when we're called in for an aggression case, it was a dog that was intended to be someone's emotional support animal or service dog. And that, I mean, I hate that conversation. It's just terrible because you know this isn't going to be successful.
Yeah. I had a case a few years ago where the dog was acquired for as an emotional support animal for the children, and the dog was biting the children. Mm-hmm. So, and the difficulty, usually that's a pretty straightforward case for many people, because they're like, all right, this is not the right dog. But, you know, sometimes the owner, the parents were so attached to the dog, they were not mm-hmm. seeing that aspect of it. And so, yeah, I remember that was a challenging conversation, but they ended up rehoming the dog, fortunately, in that case.
And I think that's often the correct decision in these cases. And I do think that we as professionals are paid for a professional opinion. That is what we are being sought after. And I think to be able to have that conversation, validating their personhood and their disability, and that their disability did not cause this to happen and was not the reason this is not successful, is also important to say, listen, this is just not very compatible. And the phrase that I use very frequently is, this is just simply not the right tool to mitigate this piece of your disability. And most individuals do understand that, because we have a lot of experience with not the right tool in other areas, whether that's not the right seizure medication, or whether that's not the right knee brace because it rubs, or whether, you know, you don't do really well with a cane, but you do really well with a walker. Most of us are pretty comfortable with that conversation in the disabled community. And so, you know, saying this dog is never going to be the right tool to mitigate your disability. So your choices are this is what it might look like to be a lovely pet dog. This is what it might look like to rehome this dog and get a different candidate that's better suited. This is what these things might look like.
That's such a great distinction in the use of the word tool versus pet or family dog, or because it brings into that side of the equation, not that we're calling the dogs like tools or utilities, but that aspect of what they're looking for is like being used as a tool in a sense. And so,
and service dogs and emotional support dogs, well, service dogs particularly, they are medical equipment. That is what they are. And I think that's always a difficult balance because it feels a little icky to call a dog equipment. But ultimately, their purpose is to serve as medical equipment. And that, you know, we always ask this question, and I've heard you ask it many times, is what is the purpose of a dog? And I think if we're asking what is the purpose of a service dog, it's medical equipment. That is the purpose.
Excellent. So let's shift to where can people learn more about people with disabilities and this topic in general and helping them? And really for us as trainers and consultants to be better trainers and consultants and humans is to learn more about the unique needs of other individuals. So where would you suggest from a dog training standpoint, I guess I should specify.
Yeah. So I think we're really fortunate in this industry that we don't have a shortage of individuals with disabilities who are working professionally in this industry. And as with all conversations of diversity and perspectives different than your own, it's much more valuable to ask questions and then actually listen to the answers rather than trying to contribute to, well, have you tried this and this and this? It's not that there's not a time and a place for that. I promise you, if I'm sitting at a table with my able-bodied friends and we're drinking a bottle of wine, we're all going to be throwing out ideas equally, and that's valuable and great. But when you, if you are trying to seek out the opinion of someone different than you or from a different perspective, you spend time on these positive reinforcement service dog training groups. Spend time in many of the organizations for service dogs are run by disabled people, many of them. You spend time with those people, ask those questions. If they are not disabled themselves, they certainly work with a lot of individuals with disabilities. If you have the opportunity to volunteer with a service dog organization, I think that is really valuable because it lets you see what this really looks like. What does it look like to handle a dog and hold a leash and have a dog in control of the handler at all times per the ADA, what we have to do with service dogs? What does that actually look like? How can you do that with somebody that is a quadriplegic? How do you do that with somebody that has very low hearing? How do you do that with low vision? Those are things that I think you can gather a lot of information that will help you relate to your clients.
Excellent information. And I will link to some of those resources in the show notes as well. Thank you, Abby, for coming on. Where can people find more about you and what are you up to as far as projects these days?
Yeah. So lately I've been, what I mostly spend my time on is I see aggression cases only with Dr. Jenny Bahunko, the veterinary behavior resident. We see all of our cases together. So I spend about 50% of my time seeing major aggression with her. And I spend the rest of my time mostly on my nonprofit. My for-profit business is being run by my manager, who's brilliant. So she's got that well in hand. And then she works with me in the nonprofit along with several other people, which is the Rover Chase Foundation. So if you guys have questions or, you know, we're in Birmingham, Alabama. So it's not like many people are like chomping at the bit to come to Alabama. They're like, what a great vacation spot. But if you want to come, we're super open to having people come and shadow us for, you know, a weekend or whatever and see what it looks like with service dogs. You know, golden retriever puppies are the cutest. So you can always come hang out with them. And our recipients are really tight knit. We have many that are local and they like to teach people. So, you know, those are things that our recipients are really excited about working with as other trainers who want to learn more about disabilities. So that's something that's open. I'm on Facebook, super active on Facebook all the time. And so you can kind of find me on social or the Rover Chase Foundation, just shoot an email. But yeah, we would love to have that conversation. And, you know, if you're working with a case with somebody with a disability, if I don't know the answer, which I very well may not, I usually know someone who does. So who has experience with that particular set of disabilities.
Excellent. Abby, thank you so much for coming on. I learned a lot. I'm sure the listeners are going to learn a lot, and I hope you can come back.
Thanks, Mike. I had a great time.
I hope you enjoyed this important conversation with Abigail as much as I did, and appreciate you tuning in to hear more about helping pet guardians who have disabilities. If you like the show, please feel free to subscribe, share, and give a rating. And hop on over to aggressivedog.com for more information about helping dogs with aggression, from the Aggression in Dogs Master Course to webinars from world-renowned experts and even an annual conference. We have options for both pet pros and pet owners to learn more about aggression in dogs.